British Sky Broadcasting presents Mississippi Burning, a Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer release in association with Orion Pictures, voiced by Tim Bruce on behalf of MCS Agency. A fading evening light creeps into a segregated public washroom. On one half of a plastered wall, a painted sign clearly reads white. On the other, fixed at a lower level, another reads colored. Below each sign, plumbed into the same water pipe that also appears to divide the two areas, stand two very different water fountains. A white man steps forward, sips from a state-of-the-art metallic water cooler that stands squarely and confidently on the floor, wipes his mouth, and leaves. A Frederick Zullo production starring Gene Hackman as Agent Rupert Anderson and William Dafoe as Agent Alan Ward. Soon after, a black child comes to drink from the colored fountain, a derelict porcelain bowl, spouting a constant, meager plume of drinking water that struggles to rise above its cup. Mississippi Burning. Gravestones and makeshift wooden crosses bear witness from a silent churchyard as a once proud church engulfed in angry flame lights up the darkness of night. Also starring Frances McDormand as Mrs. Pearl, Brad Dourif as Deputy Clinton Pearl, Ali Ermey as Mayor Tillman, Gaylard Sartain as Sheriff Ray Stuckey, Stephen Tobolowsky as Clayton Townley, Michael Rooker as Frank Bailey, Pruitt Taylor Vince as Lester Cowens, Badger Jola as Agent Monk, and Kevin Dunn as Agent Bird. Also featuring the gospel singer Lani Span McBride. The searing heat strips away the wood from the church walls and lays waste the sapling pines. A small church bell stands tarnished, yet defiant amid the raging blaze. Original music by Trevor Jones, written by Chris Geromo. The gutted remains collapse into a consuming pyre. Yet the congregation bell stands tall. Directed by Alan Parker. A lone car peaks and troughs along an undulating country road, its headlights picking through the murky light of dusk. A 1960s family car crests over a hill, disappears momentarily into a deep dip in the road, and emerges again as it journeys through an unpopulated swathe of countryside and trees. Two student-like young men sit brooding in the front, their dorsal arms propping up their tired heads. A black teenager sits wide-eyed in the back, anxiously shuffling. The front passenger closes his eyes in sleep. Some way behind them, two cars and a pickup truck undulate along the selfsame road. They drive without headlights, as if slyly stalking some prey, veering back and forth, on and off the edge of the road with impatience and chafing frustration. The lone car continues normally, unaware of the approaching pack. The pack cruises forward, as if in drilled formation. They close the gap, speeding closer and closer, until the lead car tailgates the young men's car, bearing down on its occupants with shadowy menace. The car nudges their rear bumper.
What do they want? I don't know. It's a pass.
The driver gestures to the car behind.
city.
Rammed from behind.
The fuck are these jokers playing at?
Oh, they ain't playing, you better believe it.
Having smashed into the lone car's taillights, the lead pack car accelerates again and smacks aggressively and provocatively into its back.
What are we gonna do?
I don't know. Okay, hold on, you guys.
The driver of the pursuit car spots a forest track and makes a sudden, sharp turn. The pack continues to follow them, off the main road.
There's a truck, too.
The pack turn on their headlights as the cars race along a dirt track, churning up the dust. As they file past a steamy subtropical swamp, the lead pursuit car turns on its flashing police light and continues to pressure the car in front.
Shit, it is a car.
Better stop.
Okay, sit tight, you guys. Don't say anything. Let me talk. All right, we'll be all right. Just relax.
The two young men come to a stop, and the whole convoy grinds to a halt behind them. Shadowy figures climb out of the pursuit cars and angrily slam their doors. They head towards the young men with torches in their hands, officiously inspecting the car as they approach. Glaring torch beams are shone, first into the eyes of the white driver and passenger, then at the black teenager sitting uncomfortably in the back. A man questions the driver.
Y'all think you can drive any speed you want around here?
You had us scared to death, man.
Don't you call me man, Jew boy.
No, sir, what should I call you?
You don't call me nothing, nigger-loving Jew boy, you just listen.
Yes, sir.
Hell, you even starting to smell like a nigger, Jew boy.
Take it easy, we'll be all right.
Sure you will, nigger-lover.
He's seen your face. That ain't good, you don't want him seeing your face.
Oh, it don't make no difference no more.
Oh shit, we into it now, boys.
Well, you only left me a nigger, but at least I shot me a nigger.
Yes, me.
Mississippi, 1964. As a car heads along a highway by day, a gruff-looking older man examines a dossier of photographs, one showing a processing line of figures in the white, pointy-hatted robes of the Ku Klux Klan. The man impatiently taps the photo against the file. At the bottom, he finds some sheet music and proceeds to sing to his younger, preppy-looking driver.
Now listen, you communists and niggers and Jews, tell all your buddies to spread the news. Today your judgment will soon be nigh, as the Lord in his wisdom looks down from on high. Will his battle be lost by mixing the races? We want beautiful babies, not ones with brown faces. Never, never, never I say, for the Ku Klux Klan is here to stay. Never I say, because the Ku Klux Klan is here to stay. These Ku Kluxers are better with lynchings than they are with lyrics.
Just read the file, Mr. Anderson. I can do without the cabaret.
You don't like me much, do you, boss?
Sure I like you. I just don't share your sense of humor.
Sometimes that's all you got left. How long you been to Bureau?
3 years.
Got out of college, huh?
No, from the Justice Department.
Kennedy boy, now I see.
No, I don't think you do see. Let's get this thing straight. I haven't had a pimple in years. I shave every morning. I even go to the bathroom by myself, so you can quit this boss stuff. They put me in charge because I've been through this before.
Birmingham, Montgomery?
Oxford. I was with Meredith at Ole Miss.
You got hit in the head with a brick, and so they gave you a promotion, right?
No. Shot in the shoulder.
Well, at least you lived. That's important.
No, Meredith lived. That's what's important.
A road sign proclaims, "Welcome to Mississippi, the Magnolia State."
What's got four eyes and can't see?
What?
Mississippi. never I say, because the Ku Klux Klan is here too.
The two agents arrive in the main street of a small provincial town. in a car looking very much like the one used by the murdered young men. They pass Shiloh Street and park in front of a row of small shops. A group of lackadaisical old men sit gawping from the porch of Jilly's Beauty Box and follow their every move. The two agents climb out of the car and begin to take in their surroundings.
Big building for a small town.
Anderson waves to the old men.
Howdy.
One gives him a perfunctory nod as Anderson slips on his trilby and suit jacket. He follows behind the habitually suited ward, who wipes the back of his sweltering neck as he ploughs ahead through a greenish front garden, proudly displaying a solitary statue, and into a nearby office building. The main entrance is flanked by heavy oak stairways, the paint peeling from the damp subtropical walls. Ward walks through a door, labelled Jessup County Sheriff, and approaches the duty officer busy writing at his desk.
Good morning. My name's Alan Ward. I'm with the FBI.
Federal Bureau of Integration.
That get-up, you ain't exactly undercover, are you now?
We're here to see Sheriff Stuckey.
Sheriff's right busy now. You'll have to wait or come back some other time.
We'll wait.
Annoyed, Anderson watches Ward take his seat before approaching the deputy's desk and sitting on the edge.
Listen to me, you backwoods shit-ass, you. You got about 2 seconds to get the sheriff out of here. I'm going to kick the goddamn door in, okay?
The sheriff appears from his office.
Well, hell. Looks like we got some company. Some Hoover boys come down to visit. How you doing?
Good.
I'm Sheriff Stuckey.
Rupert Anderson.
Rupert?
Uh-huh.
We've been expecting you. I assume you met my deputy, Mr. Pell.
Sure did.
You down here to help us solve our nigger problems?
No, it's just a missing person case.
Hmm. Well, come on. Say, you gonna want your boy in on this?
Sheriff, I'm Special Agent Ward, and I'm in charge of this case. We think it might be a little more serious than missing persons.
I don't think so, boy. In fact, you know what I think it is? It's a publicity stunt cooked up by that Martin Luther King fella. Come on.
Pell sniggers as they pass into Stuckey's office. Later, Ward and Anderson talk in their car.
At around 3 p.m., Deputy Pell says he arrested the three boys for speeding. He held them in jail until 10 p.m. and then released them. They drove off. He says he followed them as far as the county line and never saw them again. Why didn't they make a phone call?
Why should they?
Mr. Anderson, these boys were trained activists. They're taught to check in every hour, and if they're arrested the moment they're released from custody, the hotel is 2 minutes from the jail. They could have phoned from the lobby. It just doesn't follow.
Maybe they went for a beer.
Not these boys. The civil rights office in Rossville started making calls as soon as they didn't check in. The sheriff's office here said they had no idea where the boys were. First lie.
By who? Sheriff's office or civil rights office?
Who would you believe?
Mr. Ward, I don't know if you knew it or not, but I was a sheriff in a little Mississippi town just like this.
Yes, I'm aware of that.
Well, lying just don't come into it, you know? We were right on the border, 10 miles from Memphis and 1,000,000 miles from the rest of the world. Now, if a sheriff in a little town like this says, that's what happened, then that's what happened.
Let's go eat.
A segregated diner, busy with a lunchtime rush. Anderson loosens his tie and carries his jacket over his arm, while Ward remains in strict dress code, despite the heat. A middle-aged waitress greets them.
We're full up right now, honey. Y'all want to wait a while?
Is the wait worth it?
We're not full for nothing, sugar. Y'all want to look at a menu while you wait?
Sure enough.
Thank you.
Well, what y'all gonna do, wait or leave?
We're gonna wait because we want to be near you.
There's some empty seats down there.
Oh, Mr. Ward. That's a color down there. I don't even think about it. There's some people over here getting ready to leave right now.
Aren't you hungry, Mr. Anderson?
Heads turn in shocked silence as Ward sits next to a black man in the colored area of the diner.
Good afternoon. A Looks good.
White eyes scrutinize his every movement. As Ward slaps his magazine down on the table, the black man doggedly avoids eye contact and carries on eating.
Do you mind if I ask you a few questions? I'm looking for some information.
I ain't got nothing to say to you, sir.
Just a few questions.
Again, he glances across at the white folks watching him.
I ain't got nothing to say to you, sir.
The black man picks up his food and moves away to another table. Ward turns to see Anderson and the whole diner watching him. Later, the two agents investigate the charred remains of a burned church building.
The three civil rights boys came here to propose setting up a voter registration clinic. Before the locals got a chance to say yes, the Klan burned them down.
Give a man a vote, but don't let him use it.
Yeah, that's the way it works.
What did their office in Rossville have to say?
They confirmed that the boys came back here to apologize to the congregation.
Sorry you folks didn't get to vote. I suppose most of you never knew you even had one. Now you got no place to go on Sunday.
Apparently, after they came back here, they talked to some locals down the road. I think that's where we should start.
Well, you can talk to them, but they won't talk to you. These people have to live here long after we're packed up and gone. They'd rather bite their tongue off than talk to us.
Bureau procedure, Mr. Anderson.
Anderson bows his head with distaste. Later, interviewing an old couple.
The church caught fire and you ran home, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And then the four white men stopped you?
Yes, sir.
And these four white men attacked your husband?
Yes, sir.
But you can't identify them.
No, sir.
Did you report this to the police?
No, sir.
But you told the civil rights boys what happened?
Yes, sir.
Ma'am, did they tell you where they were going after that?
No, sir.
Nothing?
No, sir.
All right. Thank you, ma'am.
You're welcome.
Later that night, a carload of angry white men rap on the door of a makeshift farm shack.
Come on, boy. Open up. Your brother Hollis here, Phoenix?
Yes, sir.
Well, wake his ass up. We want to see him.
Why?
Just wake him up, boy.
They chase him through the house. The men chase Hollis out into the yard. Petrified, he runs as fast as he can through the thick mud of the pig pens, but trips over a piglet and is caught. His brother watches as the thugs hold him down and kick him in the stomach. They drag him through the mud and continue their assault. Meanwhile, across town, in a quiet motel called the Court, Ward sits on his bed mulling over the photographs of the three activists, while Anderson reads through some papers.
You admire these kids, don't you?
Don't you?
I think they're being used. I think they're being sent down here in their Volkswagens and their sneakers just to get their heads cracked open.
Did it ever occur to you that maybe they believed in what they were doing?
Did it ever occur to them they're going to end up dead?
Maybe.
In Washington, they sure as hell knew, didn't they?
Some things are worth dying for.
Well, down here, they see things a little differently. People down here feel some things are worth killing for.
Holding a photo of a lynch mob victim.
Where does it come from, all this hatred?
You know, when I was a little boy, there was an old Negro farmer who lived down the road from us, named Monroe. And he was, I guess he was just a little luckier than my daddy was. He bought himself a mule. That was a big deal around that town. Now, my daddy hated that mule. Because his friends are always kidding him about, well, they saw Monroe out plowing with his new mule, and Monroe was going to rent another field now they had a mule. And one morning, that mule just showed up dead. They poisoned the water. And after that, there was never any mention about that mule around my daddy. Just never came up. So one time we were driving down the road and we passed Monroe's place and we saw it was empty. He just packed up and left, I guess, gone up north or something. I looked over at my daddy's face. And I knew he'd done it. He saw that I knew. He was ashamed. I guess he was ashamed. He looked at me and he said, if you ain't any better than a nigger, son, who are you better than?
You think that's an excuse?
No, it's not an excuse. It's a story about my daddy.
Where's that leave you?
With an old man who was just so full of hate that he didn't know that being poor was what was killing him.
A bomb blast shatters the window. Anderson grabs his gun.
Get the light! Get the light!
You all right?
Anderson peers out of the darkened room. Through the broken glass, he sees a burning crucifix standing opposite in the car park.
I guess they know we're here.
Ward sprints over the bed and out into the car park. He leaps over several railings as he skirts the walls of the motel, slipping awkwardly as he runs. By the time he reaches the road, the bombers are long gone. Ward watches them disappear, breathless and impotent. He joins Anderson, who stands dwarfed by the burning crucifix.
Now you know what you're getting into.
I'm going to call Washington. I need more agents.
Would it make any difference if I told you that's exactly the wrong thing to do?
No.
Anderson sighs as he looks up at the familiar flames. The next day, fleets of black city cars offload their agents and endless box files from their trunks. Dozens of agents move back and forth in the busy hum of important bureau work. Dossiers are wheeled on trolleys into a disused cinema. Inside, Ward has set up office. Anderson wanders down the aisle, coffee and sandwich in hand, and takes a seat towards the back of the auditorium. Ward bounces up to him.
The whole place for $75 a month. It's private, it's central, it's perfect.
There's room for 100 more agents. 200 maybe. More in the balcony.
We're just trying to find the three boys, Mr. Anderson. I'll take all the help I can get.
Putting up his feet.
When's the show start?
The sun struggles to break through the thick grey clouds that hang over a deserted cotton field. On its edge stands a cage with handfuls of ripe cotton dangling through the neat crisscross of chicken wire. Inside sits Hollis, motionless and traumatized, his eyes scouring left and right in fear of his attackers. Meanwhile, as Warden Anderson walk along the main street, a convoy of three cars arrives, one sporting the Confederate flag on its aerial. They are met by a sizable gathering from across the street.
Who's the big shot?
It's a clan. No pointy hats, but plenty of pointy heads.
Let me run a check on the plates.
The Klansmen, all well-to-do townsfolk in suits and ties, greet each other with handshakes and friendly slaps on the back. Anderson watches a moment before wandering up to the local barbershop and taking a look inside. The interior is plain, functional, and very red from the shoulder down. In a far corner, Sheriff Stuckey reads a newspaper, while the barber carefully shaves a besuited man smoking a large cigar.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Anderson, why don't you say hello to our mayor, Mr. Tillman, here?
How do you do, Anderson?
Mr. Mayor, Mr. Barber. Well, this looks like the place to be, even for me. Yeah, nothing like a barber shop for jawing your socks off.
Where are you from, anyway, Anderson?
Thornton, Mississippi, sir. Just as fit from Tennessee.
Well, then you must know how we all feel down here. We don't take to outsiders telling us how to live our lives. And I'm here to tell you our Negroes were happy till those beatnik college kids came down here stirring things up. Before that, there wasn't anybody complaining.
Nobody dared.
We got a real peaceful little community down here, Anderson. Of course, they're just like any other folks, I reckon, and push them too far. Well, I figure it's like 3 sticks of old dynamite. You shake it up, and we're going to be scraping bodies off the street.
I'm just down here to investigate the missing 3 kids, ask some questions.
Oh, if it's all boiled down to gravy, it wouldn't be enough to cover up a chicken fried steak. Them kids you're looking for, I'd just about bet you a shiny new dime. They're setting up in Chicago right now, drinking a cold beer and having a big laugh about all the commotion they've stirred up down here.
Well, I sure hope so.
Or you can tell your bosses, people got the wrong idea about the South. You know what I'm talking about. Everybody running around ragged, backwards, and illiterate, eating sow belly and corn pone 3 times a day. Simple fact is, Anderson, we got 2 cultures down here. White culture and the colored culture. Now, that's the way it always has been. That's the way it always will be.
The rest of America don't see it that way, Mr. Mayor. The
rest of America don't mean jack shit. You in Mississippi now.
That's for sure. What's the score, Mr. Barber?
St. Louis on top, 5-0.
What inning is it?
Bottom of the 7th.
You like baseball, do you, Anderson?
Yeah, I do. You know, it's the only time when a black man can wave a stick at a white man and not start a riot.
Anderson winks. Tillman and Stuckey stare back, stone-faced. Meanwhile, back at the makeshift headquarters, a.k.a. the disused cinema, Agent Bird hands Ward a sheet of paper.
Sir, we checked on the plate, sir. Clayton Townley.
Townley. Grand Wizard of the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan.
That's him. Oh, and I think we have a lead on the car, sir. Choctaw on the reservation thinks he knows where it is. We're waiting for a call.
Good.
Anderson loiters in an old-style shopping arcade and peers into the wide shop windows. 2 women, a hairdresser and a middle-aged client, emerge from a shop entrance further down the covered sidewalk.
We have your appointment for next Tuesday, right? I'll see you then. Bye-bye.
Anderson admires the younger woman from afar. As she turns, she spots him by a shop window, lingers with idle curiosity, then returns to her shop. Anderson walks casually down to her salon, Jilly's Beauty Box, and takes a good look between the window blinds. Without a second thought, he walks inside.
Afternoon, ladies.
Can I help you?
Well, yes, you can. I tell you, I hate the way I look, you know. What do you think, a permanent wave, maybe, or a bleached job or something? Now, that looks pretty good. Did you have that done in here?
No, Jackson. Oh, yeah. I think a wig's your only hope, hon. You ain't gonna be able to do much with that cue ball.
Thank you.
You don't ask us some questions, this is where you'll hear it all.
Yeah, well, matter of fact, I do. You know, I was just wondering who that gentleman was that just drove in over there. Now, I know that isn't President Johnson.
His name's Townley, Clayton Townley. Are you one of them FBI gentlemen?
Yes, ma'am, I am.
Well, if you ask me, I think it's a shame if those 2 kids are dead, but I sure hope you find them.
Thank you. Actually, it's 3 kids that are missing. There's a colored kid also.
Do you honestly think your people would be down here at all if it weren't for those 2 white boys?
Maybe not, miss.
Mrs.
Pale. Her old man's Ray Stuckey's deputy.
Mrs. Pell forces a smile.
But I'm single.
A red car screeches across the main street, and the unconscious body of a black man, Hollis, is kicked out from the back door. As they speed away, Hollis lies face down in the dust. Anderson joins a crowd of passing black folks who rush to help him when the sheriff and his deputy take charge of the situation. Ward and a posse of FBI agents sprint across from the cinema to investigate.
We'll take care of this. It's a local problem.
We'll handle this. We don't need your damn help.
The agents disperse.
Ain't right having blood on Main Street. How'd that look on the TV news?
Okay, easy.
Get up.
I got him.
Anderson upbraids Ward.
That's a kid from the diner. Now maybe you'll think twice before you talk to colored kids with an audience.
They're just sending a message from the big boss from Tupelo, and you know it.
I know it, yes. Clayton Townley, Chief Pointed Head.
Yeah, that's right. How did you know?
Bureau procedure, Mr. Ward. You ought to try it sometime.
We did. We found the car the kids were driving.
Ward slumps away, leaving Anderson in the middle of the main street. He turns and sees Mrs. Pell return to her salon. As she does so, she passes an older black man on the sidewalk and touches him reassuringly on the arm. Later, a Native American man guts a catfish outside his family home on the edge of a swampy lake. Smoke billows from the farmstead chimney, and the family is busy with a day's work. His son brings him more fish to clean as the women mend the nets and feed the chickens. Ward approaches him, followed by Anderson and a line of agents.
Good morning.
The man looks nervously at Ward's bespectacled fresh face.
Good morning.
The man puts aside his work and leads a line of a dozen or so men in suits into the swamp. Anderson shrugs his shoulders as the men wade into waist-high water, dressed as if they were taking a shortcut to the office. Anderson stumbles in the mud and grabs hold of a branch sticking out of the water. The Native American man trudges on past mangrove trees with thick root bases, like elongated pyramids with thinning branches that struggle for survival in the meager swamp. As the men round a corner, they spot something in the trees. The rusty hulk of a car with all its windows smashed. Later, a tow truck drags the car out of the muddy swamp using two metal cables. The wheels spin on the muddy bank before finally yanking out the car from its resting place. Putrid water pours out of the doors and petrol cap. Agent Bird plodges through the muddy reeds towards Warden Anderson, carrying a box of items.
Two beer cans, a Coca-Cola bottle, green plastic bottle, badly burned wristwatch stopped at 12:45, a set of keys. No bodies.
I want the entire area searched. Every inch.
Yes, sir. It's a big swamp.
Every inch, Mr. Bird.
Anderson finds a car key among the contents.
I guess they never left Mississippi.
Yeah, they're dead. They're dead.
Mr. Bird?
Yes, sir.
There's a telephone back at the truck stop. Get to it, get on it, and get me 100 more men here by morning.
100?
100.
What, bureau people, sir?
I don't care if it's a goddamn army. I want this entire swamp searched.
Yes, sir.
Don't do it, Mr. Ward. Let's start a war.
It was a war long before we got here.
A convoy of gray military buses edges along a dusty track surrounded by lush greenery and overhanging trees. Meanwhile, a house named Freedom is blown to smithereens in broad daylight. Bricks and splintered wood spew in all directions. The buses journey on, carrying apprehensive ratings from the U.S. Navy reserves. That night, a white man kicks down the door of a wooden country church and hurls in a petrol bomb. Elsewhere, another throws a demijohn of Molotov cocktail through the window of the Church of the Nazarene and drives off into the night. an older black man is awakened by four white men who burst into his bedroom and drag him out into the yard. They douse the pews and prayer books of an adjoining church with a can of petrol and scare the man away.
Get the fuck out of here, man! Go!
They watch from outside as fire begins to consume the church. Meanwhile, back at the Court Motel, large numbers of slick-looking agents arrive in their city suits looking for board and lodging. Across the swamp from where they queue for reception, yet another church torches the night air with conflagrating bile. Later, the cinema headquarters hums with the activity of agents sorting through countless files and papers, arranging desks and chairs, and pursuing their inquiries by telephone. Ward supervises from the circle above when he's joined by Agent Bird.
Sir, the sheriff's alibi is solid. He's playing poker with his wife's brother and two cousins.
The whole time?
Well, for 3 hours. He lost $11.38. There's something else, sir. We're having a little trouble with the motel manager.
What kind of trouble?
Well, he wants us out. He says we're bad for business.
Buy it.
Sorry, sir?
Buy it. The motel.
Well, how high can I go?
Whatever it takes.
The bustle continues. Later, agents and naval ratings take to the water on foot and in small boats and start dragging the swamp for the missing bodies. TV camera crews film the action from the muddy banks.
Today in Jessup County, Mississippi, amidst the violence that has erupted here this week, the eyes of the nation have been firmly fixed on the search for the three missing civil rights workers.
Well, I think it ought to be hoax, but if they are in that there swamp, then they ask for it.
Naval reserves have been brought in to join scores of FBI agents in their search for the missing men.
Well, I think they planned the whole thing. They're sitting up there in New York laughing at us Mississippi folks.
You think it's a hoax?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a big hoax. They ain't not gonna find nothing.
Civil rights leaders here are still optimistic as to the young men's whereabouts. But privately, there is mounting concern that they will ever be found alive.
They came down here looking for trouble, and I think they found it.
This is Merrick Barlbobby, Network News, Jessup County, Mississippi.
Sheriff Stuckey.
Tell you what I think they ought to be doing. They ought to be looking up there in Canada, them boys, instead of our swamps around here. I'll tell you something else, too. I think it's a publicity stunt dreamed up by these NAACP people.
NAACP?
I bet you all don't even know what it stands for. It's for niggers, alligators, apes, coons, and possums. Tell you what you got. You got your NAACP, you got your SNCC, you got your COFO. And you know what all that mess is? B-U-L-L-S-H-I-T. You got it?
A teenager addresses a gathering of black folks in a burnt-out church.
One day there'll come a time when we won't have to say, "Good morning, sir, Mr. Sheriff." Maybe there'll come a time when we won't have to say, "Mr. Stuckey." One day there'll come a time when we just say, "Stuckey," or "Sheriff." And one day there'll come a time when the sheriff won't even be a white man.
The people slowly scatter as they see Ward's approaching car. Only the boy and his father, dressed in their Sunday best, remain in the ash and debris of the desecrated church.
Hello. I wonder if I could ask you a few questions.
I don't suppose you could tell what kind of flower these are, could you? I've been seeing them all over the place here, and never saw such a darn pretty plant.
They're trumpet pitchers.
Trumpet pitchers? They're beautiful.
They really are.
They don't smell so good, but they're really pretty. It's nice talking to you. Sorry about interrupting your meeting here, but we can't seem to get anybody to talk to us. You just zip up, like my mama used to say.
The reason people don't want to talk to you is because they're afraid it'll get back to the law.
We are the law.
Not around here, you ain't.
We were sent here to find out what happened to those three boys. They were here to help you.
It ain't colored folks you should be talking to.
Who should we be talking to?
Come on, yeah.
You should start with the sheriff's office.
Why aren't you afraid?
How come you ain't?
Aaron? Aaron, come on, son.
Father and son leave quickly. Anderson winks at a smiling ward. Later, Deputy Clinton Pell watches baseball on TV while eating his dinner. Clinton gestures to his bored-looking wife to answer the door. She puts down her embroidery and greets the callers in her flowery dressing gown.
Good evening, Mrs. Pell. I'm Agent Ward. This is Agent Anderson. We're with the FBI. Is your husband home? We'd like to have a word with him.
Yeah, I'll come in there.
Clinton stops mid-mouthful and holds his beer quizzically in his hand.
The FBI gentleman, Clinton, they want to ask you some more questions. You want me to put your dinner in the oven?
Leave slow.
Mind if I take a seat?
Ward opens his briefcase.
What's so goddamn important you got to bother me at home?
Well, I just wanted to run through once again your movements on June 21st.
June which?
June 21st. Now, Deputy, we both know what day we're talking about, so let's do this civilized, and the sooner you can get back to your ball game, and we can get back to Washington.
Anderson wanders towards the kitchen where Mrs. Pell washes the dishes. He leans against the doorpost.
Please, don't let me interrupt you. It's just that when you heard a question ask a dozen times, it gets kind of boring.
Yeah, I guess so.
She coyly dries her hands on a cloth.
You don't eat together?
He works funny hours. You think that's odd?
No. No, I work funny hours myself.
I eat when I'm hungry, eats when he can. Can I get you something?
No, no. Thanks. It's a nice house. How long you lived here?
I was born here. But my father lost the house in a poker game one night a long time ago. We've been paying rent ever since.
It's a wicked game. Poker.
Wicked.
Mr. Anderson? It's nice talking to you. Guess I gotta go.
Clinton opens the door for them to leave.
And pork chops still any good, honey? Bring me a beer, will you?
Good night. Let's get back to baseball. You know what they say, don't you? It's the only game where a black man can wave a stick in a white...
I already heard that.
Anderson pokes him playfully in the stomach as they leave. Ward as they walk to the car.
50 minutes of his alibi hinges on his wife. You talk to her. What's she like?
She's a nice lady.
Tell me, Mr. Anderson, how does a woman like that end up with...
With shithead in there? You know what these small towns are like. A girl spends her entire time in high school looking for the guy she's going to marry and spends the rest of her life trying to figure out why.
There's something wrong with him. He's too confident.
What? Did you see the wedding photograph?
No.
His three pals, the ushers, they had this way of hooking their thumbs in their belts with the three fingers pointing down like that.
So what is that? Some sort of Masonic thing?
No. KKK.
Later, Anderson watches Deputy Pell help a drunk into his squad car.
I know you ain't drunk. Ain't more. That's right. Ain't drunk.
It's gonna take you where you can sleep it off. Alright, hold up.
Watch your head.
Anderson turns on his lights and discreetly follows Pell in his car. Later that same night, Anderson finds some white trumpet pitchers growing by the roadside and cuts a bunch with his knife. Small insects buzz around his head in the spilling light from a nearby building. He returns to Pell's house and pulls on a chain to ring the bell. A surprised Mrs. Pell opens the door in her slip. Embarrassed, she quickly pulls on her dressing gown to hide her undress.
Hi, there was a couple things I need to check with you.
My husband's not here.
Well, actually, it was you I wanted to talk to.
Me? Yeah. Okay, you better come in then.
Just take a minute. My boss, he's kind of a pain, you know, the college kid. He has to dot all the I's and cross all the T's.
What is it you wanted to ask me about?
Well, it's a time type thing. A couple things we're just not so clear about.
Would it be better if I put your flowers in some water while you're here?
Well, actually, they're for you.
They're beautiful.
They are pretty, aren't they? They don't smell so nice, but they're pretty.
Can I get you anything? Would you like some tea?
Yeah, well, thanks.
As she leaves with her flowers, Anderson looks around the room, picks up the framed wedding photo he noticed on his first visit, and takes a good look at the other men in the group. On returning, she leans against the doorpost.
Oh, don't you look at that. It's a terrible photo.
Oh, I don't know about that. Is this recent?
No, I wish.
This sure looks recent to me.
We were married 14 years ago.
Are you kidding me? No. Come on.
You take sugar.
Sure do. You know, I grew up in a town like this.
You were smart enough to leave.
Why didn't you?
For better or for worse. How about you? Are you married?
Two. Well, I was, as I remember. It didn't last very long. I was never home. I guess she got fed up with phone calls from Miami and postcards from Des Moines. There was always a guy around. Any guy that could spare the time for a movie or a beer or a quarter for jukebox. She left. How about you?
You know the South, Mr. Anderson. You leave high school, marry the first boy, makes you laugh.
Hey, your husband's quite a guy. You know, my boss has this thing about an hour, 50 minutes to be exact, that your husband says that he's with you. And I guess he was.
Guess he was.
Well, that's a pity. Because that means that I don't have an excuse for hanging around here anymore. Well, thank you for the iced tea.
Thank you for the flowers.
Sure.
He heads for the door.
Do you know what kind they are?
A fellow told me they're called trumpet pitchers.
That's right. My daddy used to call them ladies from hell because they're kind of...
carnivorous.
That's a word.
Yeah.
He's got pretty colors, the bait, insects just home on in there, and wham, they're dead, even before they got the shoes off.
He smooths her hair.
Maybe I should have picked something more appropriate.
Maybe.
He gazes at her a moment, before letting himself out. She watches him go, toying with one of the flowers. A black congregation at church, including Aaron and his father. Footsteps outside as someone gets out of a truck. White men cover their faces with hoods and carry sticks.
Peace.
A large group of hooded men stand and wait outside, impatiently twiddling their heavy bats. As the congregation begin to leave, at first they don't see the waiting mob. Then panic sets in. Terrified churchgoers make a desperate bid to run away and escape, but are hounded by the hooded mob that hunts them down with vitriolic aggression. Aaron watches with frozen disbelief as the indiscriminate mob lays into men, women and children with bats and boots, beating them into brutal submission. An older woman is mercilessly kicked down a steep bank. A savage violence rages around him like a maelstrom. Aaron kneels on the earth and closes his eyes in fervent prayer. The victims make no attempt to defend themselves. Most of the thugs scarper off down the road. One hangs menacingly close to Aaron, watching him pray, before kicking him in the face and grabbing him by the shirt.
You've already been told once, nigger. Now we don't want to have to tell you again. You go making any more trouble or flapping them boot lips off to any of them federal men, and we sure as hell gonna have to put you in the ground, boy, and that's without a pine box. You understand me?
The hooded man boots Aaron in the stomach and kicks his prayer book, before leaving him reeling on the ground. Next day, a TV crew interviews a local woman by the swamp.
How do you think the Negroes have been treated here in Mississippi?
They're treated about fair. About as good as they ought to be.
A network news van wheel spins in the mud. A local pig farmer.
If you ask me, the niggers around here have been treated awful bad for a long time.
Hundreds of Navy reserves and agents continue to drag the swamp for the missing bodies.
Again, I think Martin Luther King's one of the leaders. I mean, J. Edgar Hoover said that he was a communist, and they had proof to that effect, but, you know, I don't know that for sure. I hadn't seen it myself, but that's what they say.
More TV cameras roll in to catch the action. Agents in suits search a pig farm and fall in the thick mud. Meanwhile, local white folks mock the recovery efforts from a high bridge.
They say we've got to eat together and use the same bathroom as the niggers. And that's awful hard for some Mississippi folks to do.
They're not like us. They don't take baths. They stink. They're nasty. They just not like white folks.
The group on the bridge brawl with a TV crew.
What do you think has happened to the three boys?
Dead. Just as dead as they can be.
I feel so good. She's asleep. Oh, my God. I'm sorry I woke you up. Oh, yeah. You
Bye, hon. I'm going to be a couple hours.
All right.
Well, Mary, is that your Betsy's kid?
Yeah. She's growing up real quick, ain't she?
The arrival of Clinton Pell causes the black woman to leave.
Two still be just fine on those, Mary.
Without even raising her eyes, Mary carries away the baby and a bag of dirty washing.
Funny. Their kids are so cute.
Mayor Tillman readies himself before a TV camera.
There we go. Is that thing back on me again? If the entire Secret Service couldn't protect the President of the United States, how in the hell are we supposed to protect a few Negroes? I'm telling you again, it ain't nothing but a bunch of low-life white trash drinking too much cheap alcohol. More like paint thinner and snake juice, because this state's as dry as a martini, and we got the alcoholics to prove it.
Excuse me. Give me a little room here. Excuse me about it. Is this okay? Your name, please? Clayton Townley, local businessman.
Are you, sir, a spokesman for the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan?
I told you, I'm a businessman. I'm also a Mississippian and an American. And I am getting sick and tired of the way many of us Mississippians are having our views distorted by you newspaper people and on the TV. So let's get this straight. We do not accept Jews because they reject Christ. And their control of the international banking cartels are at the root of what we call communism today. We do not accept papists because they bow to a Roman dictator. We do not accept Turks, Mongols, Tartars, Orientals, nor Negroes because we're here to protect Anglo-Saxon democracy and the American way.
Thank you, sir.
Anderson climbs the stairs to a private club.
I swear to God, Lester, you are living proof that cousins shouldn't fuck. What I was trying to say, there's this color boy. He wants to play football for Bear Bryant over at Alabama. So Bear says, I'm going to give you a try. Calls up the newspaper.
What's it going to run with, a watermelon?
He's going to keep on running, too. He says, okay, boy, says, you get down there on one goal line. He puts a whole other team on the other goal line. The whole other team, he throws the boy the ball, and he says...
Pell and the others stare at Anderson.
Are you open?
You got to be a member to drink here.
Member? A member of what?
Member of the social club.
Oh, I thought you'd just buy me a beer.
Give him a beer, Frank.
Nice to be back in the Dry County again. When I was sheriff, about half of my take-home pay was from collecting taxes on illegal juice like this. Probably works the same here. I would think you'd haul in a tidy penny here, winking at the bootleggers.
I know nothing about that.
Thank you. Yeah. Tidy penny.
Anderson swigs from a bottle.
You got anything stronger than this, deputy?
No, we ain't.
Oh? You know, in Thornton, Mississippi, there's a joy juice still in every yard. Yeah, well, all you need is just some corn, sugar, and a pot to boil it in. I tried to take the fingerprints of this old boy one time, and he'd had his hand in a mash barrel all his life, you know. Well, there's no skin at all on there. There's no prints.
We ain't too interested in your good old Mississippi boy stories, Anderson. You ain't from here no more. Why'd you leave, anyway?
I just wanted to change the scenery. You know, the grit started leaving a bad taste in my mouth.
Well, if that's how you feel about it, Mr. FBI man, why don't you drink up that beer and get the hell on out of here and back to your commie nigger-loving bosses up north?
Well, you must not know my boss, Mr. Hoover. He's not too fond of commies. He'd be on your side there.
I don't give two shits whose side your Mr. Hoover's on, boy. All I know is we got 5,000 niggers in this county who ain't registered to vote yet. And as far as I'm concerned, they never will. So you can tell your stiff suits up there in Washington, D.C. that they ain't gonna change us one bit. Unless it's over my dead body. Or a lot of dead niggers.
You'd kill Frank? Is that what you're saying?
I wouldn't give it no more thought than wringing a cat's neck. And there ain't a court in Mississippi that'd convict me for it.
How about you, deputy? How you with wringing necks, huh?
Just keep pushing me over, boy.
Get this straight, you corno fucker. You tell your queer-ass nigger bosses up north they ain't never gonna find them civil rightsers down here. So you might as well back up your bags and head your ass on back up north where you belong.
Boy, grabbing Frank by the testicles.
And you get this straight, shit kicker. Don't you go mistaking me for some whole other body. You got your brains in your dick if you think we're just gonna fade away. We're gonna be here till this thing's finished.
Revealing his holster.
How about you, deputy? Is that gun just for show? Or do you get to shoot people once in a while?
Anderson gives Frank one last testicle squeeze, and he falls off his chair in agony.
Thanks for the beer.
As Anderson leaves, Pell seethes with anger. Later, Ward and Anderson watch a Ku Klux Klan film.
And ask them if they want to help save this country from the onslaught of integration. You know the system is, they want to throw white children and colored children into the melting pot of integration, through out of which will come a conglomerated, mulatto, mongrel class of people. Both races will be destroyed in such a movement. I, for one, under God, will die before I yield one inch to that kind of a movement.
Ward to Anderson.
Do you know how much trouble you've caused? They've been on the radio all day, everyone from Townley to the governor talking about FBI intimidation. We're not thugs, Mr. Anderson. We're going to do this thing my way.
I know, bureau procedure.
And what the hell were you doing at the beauty parlor? That was Bureau business. I want to know about it. If it wasn't, I won't allow it. Do you understand me?
In a side room.
You know what your problem is? You don't know when to speak and when to shut up. That makes you a fool. Mrs. Pell ain't going to say anything to me. Her husband doesn't want her to say. And I'm not going to choke it out of her.
This can of worms only opens from the inside.
Anderson softens. Anderson curses under his breath as Ward leaves the room. Later, a civil rights march processes through the main street. Among the largely black gathering are many white faces, including one vicar. The marchers are flanked on either side by an armed police escort and jeering crowds of angry white townsfolk. As the march passes, Anderson admires some day-old chicks in the local hardware store and buys a bag of pica nuts from the aging storekeeper. 26. Outside, Deputy Pell, wearing a riot helmet that looks pretty much like a builder's hard hat, directs the steady traffic of determined marchers. Sheriff Stuckey supervises, unimpressed, with his hands on hips. Anderson mingles with the crowds and wades through the tide of dignified marchers in their Sunday best. TV crews interview the march leaders. Angry policemen snatch away the American flag from the hands of passing marchers. As Anderson passes through a cordon of policemen, he pushes down one of the policemen's batons and makes his way to Jilly's beauty box.
Hi.
Hey now.
Just passing by, just saying hello. You're not out watching the parade.
Say, how come none of you guys ask me any questions? Seems everybody in town's been talked to except me.
Mrs. Pell places the woman under a dryer.
Why don't you send some of them good-looking FBI boys around here to talk to me?
To Mrs. Pell.
Sorry about the intrusion. I was over at the hardware store. Then. Pecan?
Sick of pecans.
Anderson and Mrs. Pell gaze out of the parlor window. Marchers continue to file past, directed by her husband, Deputy Pell. As Anderson munches on pecans, a disgruntled Mrs. Pell resolves to whisper some important information, her apprehensive eye firmly fixed on her husband, busy in the bustling street beyond. Anderson leaves discreetly. Later that night, Ward and Anderson sip coffee in their car while observing an isolated building.
How'd you find out about this?
Bureau procedure, Mr. Ward.
A police car draws up outside the building and parks next to another police car.
Sheriff Stuckey.
You got his phone call. I don't know who else was called.
Cole, where are you going, boy? Get out of here.
Pell hands a black man a bag of belongings and sees him off from the police building steps. As the man replaces the items in his pocket, a truck turns on its lights and hurtles towards him from a darkened garage.
Here they come.
Pell and Stuckey watch from the police building steps as the truck chases the man along the road.
We'll wait until they go back inside.
They continue to watch as the truck stops and two white men grab the black man, beat him up, and bundle him into their truck.
Get inside, you sons of bitches.
Come on, let's go, come on.
Wait until they go back inside. Come on.
As the truck drives away, Pell and Stuckey lose interest and finally head inside.
Let's go, come on.
Ward drives as fast as he can after the truck, which burns through the empty town in the dead of night. Ward keeps his headlights off to avoid detection and struggles to keep up with the truck as it makes a number of sharp turns around the quiet town streets. The truck speeds on through the darkness, undoubtedly the same rusty green truck that hounded the civil rights activists that fateful night. The truck accelerates towards an unmanned rail crossing, flashing its danger lights and warning of an approaching train. The train sounds its horn in warning, but the truck powers in front of the oncoming train's path and on to the other side. Anderson and Ward are forced to pull up short as a massive Trans-American goods train blocks their path. The two agents leap out of the car and try to see where the truck is heading. As the train passes, Ward and Anderson jump back into the car and continue their pursuit. They head down a dirt track lane lined by trees with no other vehicle in sight.
Turn left.
How do you know?
I don't. Just turn left.
Ward swerves sharply.
There's the truck. Yeah. Go up that little road there.
They speed past the abandoned truck.
Stop, stop, hurry.
Ward and Anderson jump out of the car and cautiously search the surrounding woodland. Anderson leads the way, his gun pointing into the darkness. At the sound of a groaning man, Ward dashes forward and finds the man beaten and bleeding. As Anderson sees off the thugs, Ward cradles the injured man and pulls up his blood-stained trousers. Anderson rejoins them.
What's wrong with these people?
Anderson shakes his head. The next day, interviewing the man's elderly parents on their porch.
Mrs. Walker, I know this is difficult for you, but I really need your help. If you could just persuade your son to press charges, then we could pick up the deputy at least, right away.
He won't talk to no one. And it won't do no good anyway.
I promise you, it will.
Leave him alone. Maybe then they'll let us alone.
The father gestures to the mother to come inside. Ward joins Anderson in the wild garden, and they leave.
If this is a pattern, I guess at least we know what happened on June 21st. Pell stopped the three boys for speeding at 3 o'clock. He held them in jail until the Klan could get organized. Then he released them at 10:30, and by that time, his buddies were ready and waiting.
No, Deputy Pell went with him that night.
I'm sure of it. You think he'll crack?
Down here, they say rattlesnakes don't commit suicide.
The agents drive past playing children. Later, Pell is flanked by his lawyers at an official interview.
Deputy Pell, did you release the three civil rights workers into the hands of the Klan on the night of June 21st?
No.
Are you yourself a member of the Ku Klux Klan?
No.
Have you ever been a member of the Ku Klux Klan?
No.
Are you familiar with the term Grand Cyclops?
I've heard of it.
Were you, in fact, the Grand Cyclops of the East Mississippi Clavern of the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan for the past 3 years?
Objection. My client's already told you. He's not even a member of the Klan.
Objection. This is just an interview, sir. There's really no need to be so formal.
Well, if it's just an interview, I guess I don't have to stay here, do I? I got work to do.
Pell leaves with his lawyers.
I guess you do too, don't you?
Yes, sir, and you can be sure that we'll do it.
Good luck.
Y'all good enough to indict me, you know where to find me.
Pell is met in the lobby by Sheriff Stuckey, and the press wait outside.
How'd it go?
Fine, just fine.
Don't you worry about a goddamn thing.
Here he is.
Are you cooperating in this investigation?
We're cooperating just like we have all along. Think one damn iota evidence.
Sir, could you not do that, please?
Sir, could you not do that, please?
Frank attacks a cameraman.
Don't you stand or get the fuck out of here! We have to tell you 2,000 times, now get out of here and go back where you belong! Get out of my face! Get on out of here and leave us alone! Leave us alone! Go on home where you belong, boy. You're going to get hurt now.
Mayor Tillman to Ward.
Mr. Ward, this is getting to be just about as much as we can take. I cannot register my complaints more strongly.
Not now, sir.
Now, you just a minute. I resent your public pursuit of my sheriff's department. You have made every effort to implicate them in these disappearances. but your goddamn slimy innuendos are not evidence that they were in any way connected with any crime.
We're just trying to get to the truth. It's frustrating for us, too.
Any jackass can point a finger, Ward, but that ain't evidence. Now, down here, us old cotton choppers are still stupid enough to believe in democracy. And you can rest assured, sir, we know our rights under the law.
Well, you know something, all right. I bet a cotton chopping dollar on that.
You know what, Anderson? You're starting to get so far up my nose, I'm beginning to feel your boots on my chin. And I'm telling you one more time, Mr. Appleread, a couple of crazies dressed in bedsheets dancing around the countryside scaring Negroes is not the goddamn fault of the entire state of Mississippi.
I'm telling you, Tillman, there are three dead kids out there somewhere and a lot of scared people because of your goddamn sheriff's department, so you better get used to having us around.
And you better get used to my boots on your chin, too. And you people better back off. Goddamn FBI, just who in hell do they think they are coming down in my part of the goddamn country?
You have a statement, Mr. Mayor.
You goddamn right, I got a statement.
For a moment there, Mr. Anderson, sounded like we were both on the same side.
Anderson smiles back. Mrs. Pell drives her old pink car along a side street and into a grassy driveway. Anderson pulls up in the road opposite and maintains his distance. As Mrs. Pell carries her groceries from the car in a brown paper bag, her neighbor appears with a child in her arms.
Are you all right, honey?
Yeah, I'm fine.
Let me know if you need anything.
Thanks, I will.
As Mrs. Pell walks along the wooden porchway, she turns around and sees Anderson sitting in his car across the street. Anderson watches her. Before being distracted by her neighbor playing with her cherubic toddler in the front garden. Mrs. Pell enters the house, then leans wistfully against the back of the front door. Anderson turns his car around and drives away. The next morning, outside town in a rural black area, a young boy slips on his shirt as he enters a chicken run. He checks the nesting boxes and soon finds an egg. As he closes the door to the pen, he hears an approaching truck. The same rusty green truck as the other night. Huddling into the driving cab are four redneck white men. They look around suspiciously as the driver throws a smoking box onto the porch of one of the houses. As the truck drives away, the box bursts into flame and finally explodes. A black teenager runs for his life out of the burning house and watches in his boxer shorts from across the street as his house is consumed by fire. Later, Agents Ward and Bird survey the scene.
There's no sign of him, sir. He's long gone. His mother, she lives across the street. She won't talk to us. She won't even answer the door.
I want the whole area covered. Someone must have seen something.
They won't talk to us, sir.
Get going, Mr. Bird. If they won't talk to us, shake it out of them.
Outside, a whole host of agents attempt to gather evidence and witness statements from the locals. Anderson stands by and watches. Ward confronts him.
Sending all these white guys chasing around these dog trots with their little notebooks. Gonna get you nowhere.
Okay.
What would you do?
Later, Anderson sits with Aaron and the young black boy who saw the truck.
It's okay to be afraid.
The frightened boy looks Anderson up and down.
Go on, Willie. Tell him what you saw.
Willie looks across at Ward. Later, Willie sits in the back of Ward's car with a cardboard box covering his head. He peeps out through a letterbox hole cut in the front, nervously glancing left and right. As Bird drives, Ward comforts the boy by placing his arm around his shoulders and whistling a tune to distract his mind from fear of retribution. Later, a judge delivers his sentence in a busy courtroom.
The defendants will rise. In this country, a man's home is his castle. That is one of the principles by which this community survives. You men have done violence to that principle. But I want you to know that the court understands that the crimes that you have committed have been, to some extent at least, brought about by outside influences.
White folks murmur below, while black folks sit in silent segregation in the gallery above.
Outsiders have come into Jessup County, and they've been people of low morality and unhygienic. And their presence here has provoked a lot of people. So the court understands, without condoning them, mind you, that the crimes to which you men have pled guilty were, to some extent at least, provoked by these outside influences. So, with all this, I'm going to make your punishment light. I'm going to sentence you each to 5 years in prison. But I'm going to suspend these sentences.
Anderson leaves in disgust as the jubilant defendants are congratulated by their very white friends. Black folks look down from the gallery in stunned disbelief. Ward catches their eye, and they stare back at him blankly. Later, angry black folks run riot as violence erupts onto the streets of Jessup County. They set fire to houses, upturn cars, and smash anything in their path. Ward and Anderson approach a police roadblock and are stopped by one of Stuckey's officers.
Can't go in there, sir.
FBI, let us through.
I'm sorry, sir, you can't go in there.
Ward and Anderson climb out of the car and approach Pell and Stuckey.
Sheriff!
Stuckey tokes on a cigar.
Looks like y'all really started something this time.
Can you move these cars? I want to go in and talk.
No, you're going as far as you're going to go.
This ain't nothing we can't handle.
Just a bunch of crazy colors tearing up their own assholes.
Local problem.
Faced with Pell and Stuckey's intransigence, Ward and Anderson head back to their car. Amid the barking of caged police dogs, Anderson watches the riot from the comfort of the passenger seat.
Look at those planes, Mr. Ward. That's why they sent you down here, wasn't it?
It would have happened anyway, and you know it.
You know, if I was a Negro, I'd probably think the same way they do.
If you were a Negro, nobody would give a damn what you thought.
Ward reverses away from the roadblock. Later that night, something spooks the horses at an isolated farmstead. Four white men, one carrying a large rope, emerge from the shadows and creep around the edge of a barn. The horses gallop away as smoke billows from the barn, which explodes into flames. Livestock are trapped inside. In the farmhouse, Aaron's father wakes him up from his bed.
Aaron, take your mama, your grandmama, and the children out the back door. You hear? When you hit the road, keep going. You understand? Keep going, son.
Nathan! Come on, Nathan. Get up, Nathan, now. Come on. Get out the bed.
Man. What's happening?
Come on, Mama. Let's go. Come on, Mama. Come on, y'all.
Get out, Chad.
Come on, Grandma. Let's go.
As the rest of the family escape out the back, Aaron's father loads a shotgun and runs towards the barn.
If you're in there, come on out. You hear? I ain't taking this shit no more.
As he tries to free his cattle, a stick comes crashing down on his head. And he falls faint in the mud. They drag him a few feet onto dry ground and bind his hands behind his back like an animal. A ready-made noose dangles from a tree. Frank slips the noose over the man's bleeding head, and they haul him up to hang.
Seek not his favor.
The mob tie the rope securely to the tree trunk and watch him choke to death, his legs kicking in the fight for breath. A moment later, they disappear into the night. Aaron comes running and sees his father hanging from the tree, the last twitches of life coursing down his legs. He quickly unhitches the rope, and his father drops heavily to the ground.
Okay, Papa. I'm in the golden pine. They just cracked your head, son. You just keep on beating. Don't you go dying on me now. You hear me? It's gonna be just fine.
Aaron cradles his father's head. Behind them, the burning barn. The next morning, flies buzz around the charred remains of cattle, lying where they fell in the midst of the ashen barn. Anderson stares at the skeletal body of a dead cow and shakes his head. Ward joins him.
You know, cows won't run away. No one knows why. They're just stupid, I guess. They just stand there until their bellies swell up and they pop.
Their relatives in Detroit.
Are they gonna go?
I didn't give them any choice.
At least we know who did this.
We did.
Well, don't fret. It's progress. 20 years ago, they'd have strung them up for stealing watermelon.
I don't understand you, Mr. Anderson. Not at all.
Let's get something straight, all right? This whole thing was fucked up. The moment we turned it into a show for the newsman.
The moment those three kids disappeared, it was news.
The moment the three civil rights workers disappeared, it was news. To me, they're just kids. They're still missing.
What's missing is the 15 minutes Pell said he was with his wife.
Okay.
Anderson glances across at Aaron sitting solemnly on a smoking pile of wood. That night, Clayton Townley addresses an exclusively white political rally beneath a banner that reads, Never, Never, Never.
I love Mississippi. They hate Mississippi. They hate us because we present a shining example of successful segregation. These northern students with their atheist communist bosses that have come into our community this summer with the wish to destroy it, this week have taken a terrible blow. This week, their cause has been crippled. This week, all of these federal policemen you see out here prying into our lives, violating our civil liberties, have learned that they are powerless against us if every single Anglo-Saxon Christian one of us stands together. This week.
Warren,
in your company, sir.
You got no right to be here. This is a political meeting.
Doesn't smell that way to me, deputy.
It's a goddamn political meeting, Hooper boy.
Well, it looks like a political meeting, but smells more like Klan to me. With or without the Halloween costumes. Gentlemen?
In the courts of Mississippi, they have been reminded that they cannot by force turn our communities into replicas of their communities. Communities in which Negroes run riot, unrestrained and unpunished, as they do this summer in the streets of Harlem, or they do in the streets of Oakland, or they do in the streets of Chicago!
Meanwhile, across town, Anderson drives through a deserted main street in the dark of night. He stops outside Jilly's beauty box and watches Mrs. Pell close the blinds for the night. After a moment's thought, he carries on his way. Anderson drives round to the back of the salon, quietly parks his car, and turns off the lights. He cautiously looks round as he climbs out of the car and makes his way towards the back entrance. He mounts the stairs, tugging on a rickety railing, and knocks on a shabby door. A serious-looking Mrs. Pell opens the door to him.
Can I come in?
She nods. He enters, closes the door behind him, and follows her into the salon.
It's not good for you to be here.
Why?
It's ugly. This whole thing is so ugly. Have you any idea what it's like to live with all this? People look at us and only see bigots and racists. Hatred isn't something you're born with. It gets taught. At school, they said segregation's what's said in the Bible. Genesis 9, verse 27. 7 years of age, you get told it enough times, you believe it. You believe the hatred. You live it. You breathe it. You marry it.
Anderson puts his hands on her shoulders in an attempt to comfort her, but she pulls away, walks guiltily into the next room and leans against a table. Anderson is stumped for a moment, then decides to follow her. They stand opposite each other in the moonlight, and Anderson places his hand back on her shoulder.
My husband drove one of the cars that night. That's what you want to hear, isn't it? The bodies are buried on the Roberts farm in an earthen dam.
The two embrace each other and kiss, silhouetted against a moonlit window. The next day, agents make a grisly find as they excavate by a river.
Sir?
Ward and Anderson rush to the scene across swathes of dredged mud and into a wide trench. On seeing the find, Ward takes a handkerchief from his pocket and places it over his mouth. Anderson helps Bird to the river, and he throws up in the water. Later that night, the bodies are transported by van and carried by Pell and Stuckey past eager TV crews into the coroner's department of Jessup County Hospital.
Bodies of the three missing civil rights workers were discovered this afternoon at an undisclosed grave. Neither the FBI nor the Sheriff's Department will comment on the case. Bodies have been brought here to Jessup County Hospital, where officials have also refused comment. There is speculation that there will be an autopsy performed later tonight.
Pell wheels one of the bodies on a trolley.
Keep it open. Open it up. Come on, open it up.
A policeman blocks the way forward for the press as the officers continue on their journey, wheeling the bodies along winding pipeline corridors. As Pell rounds a corner, Stuckey grabs him by the jacket, pulls him into a side room and shuts the door behind him.
Clinton, you got some problems at home you need to tend to.
What do you mean?
I mean pull your head out of your ass and get home.
A bored Mrs. Pell sits at home in front of the TV.
I'm the cheddar cheese champion of the world. In international competition with 42 other entries, my cheddar won first prize based on flavor, texture, appearance, and color.
Clinton bursts in, followed by Frank and two others.
Clinton, I didn't expect home so early. I'm fine.
Clinton beats her.
I'm sorry.
Back at the cinema, Bird hands Ward a coffee as he answers the phone.
Sir?
Say again? I'll be right there.
Ward approaches Bird.
Mr. Bird?
Yes, sir.
Get 5 men and meet me outside. Where's Anderson?
He's at the motel, sir.
Ward, Bird, and 4 others hurry to the hospital.
You two take the front door. If anyone tries to get past you, break them down. You two take the door on the corridor. Mr. Bird?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Go get Anderson. Bring him here. Don't tell him why. Don't tell him anything. Just get him here.
Mrs. Pell lies unconscious in a hospital bed, in a quiet room of her own. Ward enters, relaxes in a nearby chair, and keeps vigil at her bedside. Anderson appears at the doorway, sees her bruised and battered face, sees the tubes feeding her through the nose, and walks away in anger. Ward chases after him.
Mr. Anderson, stop! Mr. Anderson!
What the hell?
I'm telling you to stop, and I mean it. We're not killers. That's the difference between them and us.
That's the difference between them and you!
You're not any more like them than I am.
Wrong. What do you care what I do with some sumbitch hiding behind a sheriff's badge? Don't you have the whole world to change?
That's right, and I'm changing it.
Oh, you're just as arrogant as you are stupid!
You're changing it, too.
My damn well, I'm gonna make some changes right now.
Don't be so stupid. Don't go messing this up just because you're partial to fooling around with witnesses. You...
Anderson slaps Ward in the face. The two men fight against the bonnet of a car until Ward finally gets the upper hand by pointing a gun in Anderson's face.
It don't mean shit to have a gun unless you're ready to use it.
I'll kill you right now if you don't listen to what I have to tell you.
Fuck you.
Let me go. Let me go.
We'll go after all of them. Together.
You wouldn't know how.
You're gonna teach me how.
You don't have the guts.
Not only do I have the guts, I have the authority.
What is that supposed to mean?
New rules. We nail them any way we can, even your way.
Is this you talking or some guy pulling your strings, huh?
Both.
We do it my way.
Your way.
With my people.
Whatever it takes. Okay.
Anderson pauses for thought and checks his knuckles for damage.
Give me a minute.
Anderson re-enters the hospital building and passes Bird, watching through the door window.
You think he would have shot me?
Oh, yes, sir.
He's a ballsy little bastard, isn't he?
The next day, a black priest addresses a black funeral congregation. Before him, a flower-decorated coffin.
They want me to say, let us not forget the 2 white boys also died helping Negroes help themselves. They want me to say, we mourn with the mothers of these 2 white boys. But the state of Mississippi won't even allow these white boys to be buried in the same cemetery as this Negro boy. I say, I have no more love to give. I have only anger in my heart today, and I want you to be angry with me. I am sick and I am tired, and I want you to be sick and tired with me. I am sick and tired of going to the funerals of black men who have been murdered by white men. I am sick and tired of the people of this country who continue to allow these things to happen. What is an unalienable right if you are a Negro? What does it mean equal treatment under the law? Liberty and justice for all. Now I say to these people, look at the face of this young man and you will see the face of a black man. But if you look at the bloodshed, it is red, it is like yours, it is just like yours.
Out of town, Anderson introduces Ward to some official-looking hard men in grey suits and trilbies. Meanwhile, the strain of the funeral begins to show on the murdered boy's family, who sit beside his coffin, inconsolable with tears. Later that evening, Mayor Tillman leaves his mansion-like home and heads towards his car. On the way down the garden path, he adjusts his trilby, fiddles with a large cigar, and buttons up his suit jacket. Just before he jumps into his car, he discards his cigar into the gutter, then climbs into the driver's seat. Suddenly, someone grabs him from behind, tapes his mouth, and handcuffs his wrists behind his back. As night falls, Tillman's car is parked outside an isolated farmhouse. A terrified Tillman sits inside at a table, gagged and bound, opposite a man dressed in a hood with eye holes cut out, a la KKK. A black man removes his hood and stares coldly at Tillman.
You. I'm going to tell you a story. Young kid named Homer Wilkes lives about 30 miles north of here. He'd just taken his girlfriend home and was walking back along the road. A car pulled up. Three white boys took him for a ride. Now, he hadn't done anything. Except be a Negro. And they took him to a shack. Shack like this one. And they took out a razor blade. Regular old razor blade like this one. And they pulled down his pants. They spread his legs. And they sliced off his scrotum. Put it in a coffee cup. Do you know how much you bleed when somebody cuts off your balls?
Throwing the paper cup at Tillman.
When they found Homer, they say he looked like he'd been dipped in blood up to his waist. He was barely alive when they got him to the hospital. And he can hardly walk now.
The man drags Tillman to his feet, loosens his trousers, and threatens him with a razor blade.
Mayor, we know you know who was there when those three civil rights boys was murdered. We know you know who pulled the trigger.
Tillman struggles to shout through the tape.
Is there something you want to say to me?
Tillman nods, and the tape is ripped away. Later, the man waves goodbye from a small plane. Ward to Anderson at a rainy airfield.
Is he with the Bureau?
Yeah, he's kind of a specialist.
You sure the mayor won't talk about any of this?
No, they kill it!
All right, what do you have?
Well, there were three cars, seven men involved. Pell and Bailey, they did the killing.
Sheriff Stuckey?
Yeah, he knew about it, but he's too smart to be there. So Pell pulled the trigger for him.
And Townley?
It was his idea. Grand Dragons, they don't get their hands dirty.
The whole thing, huh? Bullet by bullet. I don't suppose you're interested in words like coercion or hearsay or duress. This is no good in court.
We're not in court, Mr. Ward. We'll never get him on murder anyway. That's a state charge. These Hastings will never prosecute.
I know that.
Well, we've got to get him in federal court. Violation of civil rights.
Just don't lose sight of whose rights you're violating.
Don't put me on your perch, Mr. Ward.
Don't drag me into your gutter, Mr. Anderson.
These people crawled out of a sewer, Mr. Ward. Now maybe the gutter's where we should be.
Ward hands a notebook with Tillman's statement back to Anderson.
Thank
you. Anderson's irate breathing slows to normal, and he smiles as he looks down at the notebook. The next day, Lester Cowens leans on his car smoking, as he and others wait for Clayton Townley, who arrives by car at a red brick church. As the car pulls up, Lester opens the door for Townley to step out.
This better be important.
Pell, Stuckey, Frank, Lester, and four others sit waiting in the pews.
Who the hell called this meeting?
We thought you did.
Of this group? Are you stupid? Wait, you didn't call this? Shit, now, if you didn't call this, who the fuck did?
Shut up!
Now, wait a minute. Well, is this some kind of bullshit setup? Ray, are you sure you didn't call this? Because I got a note from my wife, and it said it was from you and Clinton. Now, that's...
Lester, shut up!
Now, we're all going to walk straight out of here and say nothing.
That means nothing, Lester. First one opens his mouth's a dead...
Shut up!
Hey, Clinton.
Outside, Anderson records the conversation on tape.
Looks like the rattlesnakes are starting to commit suicide.
Among the vehicles to leave in a hurry is the same old rusty green truck that accompanies each racist action. Ward and Anderson drive on. Later that day, Anderson and one of the new Hardman agents visits Lester in his rundown cobbler's workshop. Lester stops his sewing machine as soon as he sees them.
Hi, Lester.
Lester's workmates watch closely.
We'll give you that ride home.
What?
Well, I know you said 4:30, but we're running a little late, so, I'll meet you in the car.
You're cracked.
You have change of a 20?
As Lester opens the till, the agent jams in his fingers.
Get in the car, Lester. Else you're going to have a mighty hard time picking your nose once I've closed this drawer shut.
Lester rides in the back of Ward's car. Anderson.
Lester, you can make it a whole lot easier on yourself by going on a record right now.
I ain't got nothing to say. You barking up the wrong tree, mister.
Lester, I got to tell you something. We got you cold. Your buddies have already talked.
You're lying.
People notice Lester in the agent's car.
You think you're in a lot of trouble, Lester. We know you drove the second vehicle, the green truck. And your buddy says, refresh my memory here, Mr. Burris.
Yes, sir. Lester Cowens dragged the Negro from the car, kicked him twice in the face, and then shot him.
That's a goddamn lie.
No, it's true. What else you got there, Mr. Bird?
Lester Cowens then said they only left me a nigger, but at least they shot me a nigger.
I didn't kill him. I only shot him in the ass.
We know that. Yeah, he's already dead by the time you put a slug in him. But your buddy sees it differently. Your buddy tells it that you killed the kid. Now, you either go on the record for us right now, or it's going to be your ass we're talking about, not just the black kids.
Lester whitens with fear. Ward drives into the heart of a nearby black area and pulls up in the street, watched closely by the locals.
Think about it, Lester. Come on,
Allie. Anderson yanks Lester out of the car, and another throws his baseball cap onto the ground. The agents drive away, leaving a petrified Lester surrounded by an entire black community. Seeing all those folks eyeballing him, Lester runs as fast as his chicken legs can carry him. Meanwhile, the black folks continue to go about their business. Later, across town, the local barber starts Clinton Pell's daily shave. Someone else takes over with the open razor. Anderson. And he starts scraping the skin on Pell's cheek. Pell's eyes open in sudden horror.
This is tricky. They make it look so easy, don't they? I got a question for you, Clinton. You don't mind if I call you Clinton, do you? I feel like I know you so well.
Shaving Clinton's neck.
Well, we have it. On the night of the murders, you made a short speech as the bulldozer buried the kids in the dam. How does Lester tell him? Mississippi would be proud of you. You've struck a blow for the white man. Is that what you said, Clinton? Is that what you said? Now, it must have been you, because Clayton Townley and Ray Stuckey, they were too smart to be there. You're too stupid to think anybody remembered what you had to say. But old Lester, he got a good memory.
Anderson draws blood with a razor.
I'm sorry. I haven't done this for a long time. Did you make a speech the night that you beat up your wife, Clinton? Huh? Did you? Did you strike a blow for the white man that night? Huh? Get out of here! You got a stupid smile, you know that, pal? Can you see it? Huh? Go on! Smile when the bulldozer ran over the black kid's body. Get here!
Dunking Pell's head into a bowl of dirty water.
Did you smile when the bodies were covered over? Get here! Get out here! Come on! Get here! Did you smile that same stupid smile? Huh? Did you? You.
Ward and Bird wait nervously outside. Hardman agents bar Ward from entering while Anderson forces Pell back into the barber's chair with a razor.
Make no mistake about it, Deputy. I'll cut your fucking head clear off and I'd give a shit how it reads in the report sheet.
Anderson spills Pell around in the chair. Having fainted, his boot repeatedly smacks against a cabinet until he eventually comes to a stop. Later that evening, Lester has dinner with his wife and toddler.
One more bite, darling, one more bite.
Lester leaves the table and heads for the fridge in the next room. As he reaches for a beer, an explosion smashes through the window of the front door. Lester leaps onto the floor for cover. His wife storms in.
You get in the bedroom and lock the door! And stay away from the windows!
Lester peers through the broken window and sees a huge burning cross outside his door. A hooded man with a rifle approaches. Lester bolts through the house and out of the back door. He hurries through the backyard, climbs into his rusty green truck, and tries to escape. Three hooded men jump into an old red truck and give chase. The red truck starts to catch up as the green truck speeds along a dark country lane, bordered on either side by tall weeds. Lester drives like a madman in a desperate attempt to lose his pursuers. The red truck draws alongside, and the two vehicles tussle for control of the road, ramming each other left and right. Finally, the red truck forces Lester off the road. The trucks come to a halt, and Lester makes a break for it on foot. One of the hooded men easily tackles him to the ground, and the others round on him. One places a rope around his neck, and they drag him towards a tree.
Please, I didn't say a thing! I swear it's a setup! I didn't say nothing! I didn't say nothing!
Two FBI cars power up the road towards them. As they approach, the hooded men scatter, leaving Lester choking on the ground. Agents chase the hooded men across ploughed fields and shoot after them to make them stop. With their breath steaming in the cold night air, Ward and Anderson walk up to Lester, who kneels on the ground beneath a tree, coughing with a loose rope still around his neck.
Lucky we've been watching your ass, Lester.
If you go on the record, Mr. Collins, we'll give you protection. If not...
Not?
They're gonna kill you anyway.
Oh. You need a toilet, Lester.
Ward and Anderson walk away as a third agent removes the noose from Lester's neck. Meanwhile, the pursuing agents slow to a halt as they give up their pretense, and the hooded fugitives remove their masks to reveal themselves as three of Anderson's Hardman agents.
That really has going, huh?
The next day, Frank works on the underside of a raised car with a blowtorch. As he puts it out and moves forward to greet a car entering his garage, he quickly realizes they're agents and makes a run for it, but heads straight for Addison, who waves a pair of handcuffs at him and winks. Later, he emerges from a courtroom hounded by the press. Frank Bailey, sentenced to 10 years imprisonment for violation of civil rights laws. Lester Cowens, sentenced to 3 years imprisonment. Bird arrests another of the Klan in a public cafe. Floyd Swilly, sentenced to 7 years imprisonment. Deputy Pell surrenders his badge and gun with an idiotic grin on his face. Clinton Pell, sentenced to 10 years imprisonment. Stuckey is led out of his office in handcuffs. Stuckey waves triumphantly to the waiting crowds. Sheriff Ray Stuckey, acquitted. Another of the Klan emerges from an outside toilet, sees a group of agents waiting by their car, and tries to run as he zips his fly. Wesley Cook, sentenced to 7 years imprisonment. Warden Bird arrests Townley as he sits in his shack-like office writing at his untidy desk. He's forced to bear the humiliation of being led past his black workers in handcuffs. One of the workers looks on with a look of silent satisfaction. Clayton Townley, sentenced to 10 years imprisonment. A man hangs by his neck from a short rope tied to the beam of a house basement. Agents Warden Bird hurry down the stairs to investigate, but the man is long dead. As they turn on the light, Mayor Tillman's lifeless face stares back at them. An agent cuts him down, and his body is carried away. Bird looks up at the beam and starts wondering.
Why did he do it? He wasn't even in on it. Wasn't even Klan.
Mr. Bird, he was guilty. Anyone's guilty who watches this happen and pretends it isn't. No, he was guilty, all right. Just as guilty as the fanatics who pulled the trigger. Maybe we all are.
Addison pulls up in his car opposite Mrs. Pell's house. He's shocked to see that the house has been ransacked and vandalized. He climbs out of his car and stands a moment, taking in the scene of destruction before him. He walks past broken chairs and other furniture strewn across the grass and enters the main doorway, the door having been wrenched from its hinges. Inside is no better, as belongings litter the floor as if after the passing of some great storm. Addison notices the wedding photo lying on the floor, picks it up to look at it again, only to discard it into a pile of debris on the sofa.
Hello?
Yeah.
Mrs. Pell stands alone in her vandalized kitchen.
I just missed you at the hospital. They said you'd gone home.
What's left of it?
I'm real sorry.
So am I.
What are you gonna do?
I don't know.
Where will you go?
I'm not going anywhere. I'm staying. This is my home. Born here. Probably die here.
He gazes at her bruised face.
If I wanted to leave, I would have done it a long time ago. Things will work out. There's enough good people around here to know what I did was right. And enough ladies like the way I fixed their hair.
They hold hands a moment. Before Addison says his goodbyes by kissing her hand, winking at her, and leaving.
Hey, If you're ever in Des Moines, don't send me a postcard.
Black and white sing together at the sight of a burnt-out church.
We cannot see in the future. No, 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 no. And it's hard to smile through trials. No, we cannot see every pitfall, but we must walk on by faith each day. Oh, Lord. Oh, on Monday.
Walk on.
And on Tuesday.
Walk on.
Oh,
let
Jesus
be.
Let him be. Can see
way
down the road. Ward to Addison as they leave.
You want to drive, Rupert? Yeah.
Oh, on Monday.
Walk on.
And on Tuesday.
In the corner of a vast graveyard, engraved on a shattered tombstone, remain the words, 1964, not forgotten. The end.
Don't worry and don't you fret. There's hope for today and tomorrow. God's got a way out of every single problem. Walk on each day. It's gonna be all right. We can change things. You're not able. Carry your load. Walk on, walk on, walk on by faith every day, each day.
Reach out, hallelujah. Reach out. Come on.
The word, if you can believe it, you can receive it.